A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one after an experience I think a lot of people have had. He was in a car park next to a high-rise development where they're excavating bedrock for the foundation. The noise was deafening, earplug territory, and the vibrations were traveling right through the ground under his feet. His question is basically, with that much force going into the ground, in a dense city with underground structures all around, how do engineers make sure adjacent buildings don't collapse or get damaged? Is there modeling done beforehand? Or do they just drill and hope?
The answer is so much more satisfying than they hope. Daniel's instinct is right. This is one of those things that feels vastly riskier than it actually is. What he was feeling in that car park, that whole body rumble that registers as something terrible is happening, is actually a carefully managed process where ground vibrations are measured in millimeters per second of particle movement. Not on any scale most people have heard of. It's not Richter, it's not decibels. It's peak particle velocity, PPV.
Millimeters per second. So the ground is moving at speeds you could beat with a sundial, and it feels like the apocalypse.
That gap between perception and reality is the whole story. The human body starts noticing ground vibration at around 0.5 millimeters per second PPV. Meanwhile, the established safe limit for a modern reinforced concrete building is 50 millimeters per second, two full orders of magnitude higher. You feel it long, long before anything is actually at risk.
Your nervous system is basically a hypersensitive seismometer that screams danger while the building is having a perfectly manageable Tuesday.
That's the paradox Daniel stumbled into, and it's why this matters right now. Urban infill development is booming globally. More people than ever are living and working next to deep excavation sites. You've got high-rises going up and gaps between existing structures, transit tunnels being bored under historic districts, data centers being sunk into bedrock in the middle of cities, and yet catastrophic building failures from adjacent excavation are vanishingly rare. When's the last time you heard of a building collapsing because of construction vibrations next door?
I can't think of one. Which, given how many construction sites I've walked past where the ground is literally shaking, is kind of remarkable.
It's not luck. It's an invisible safety net made of predictive modeling, sensor networks, and adaptive drilling techniques that turns a potentially destructive process into a routine urban operation. The sophistication of it is genuinely staggering once you look under the hood.
Where do we even start with this? What's actually happening when you feel that rumble?
We've got to start with the physics of what vibration actually is and how it travels through the ground, because that's the foundation everything else sits on. Then we'll get into the pre-construction modeling, the geotechnical surveys, the finite element analysis software that predicts where energy will go before a single hammer hits rock. After that, the real-time monitoring ecosystem that watches every tremor and can stop work in seconds. And finally, what happens when things go wrong? Because they do go wrong sometimes, and the system's response to failure is actually its best argument.
I like that arc. Physics to failure. It's like an engineering tragedy in reverse.
Or a comedy, depending on your attachment to the parking garage. But the key tension to hold on to is that the forces are real and measurable. Ground vibrations from rock excavation can exceed 50 millimeters per second peak particle velocity. That's enough to crack plaster, enough to worry about. But the engineering controls that keep them below damage thresholds are equally real, equally measurable, and legally enforceable. It's not hope, it's physics with paperwork.
Physics with paperwork? That might be the most reassuring phrase I've ever heard you say.
It should be, because the paperwork is what makes the physics predictable. Every major excavation in a dense urban area starts not with a drill but with a vibration control plan, a document that says exactly what the limits are, how they'll be monitored, and what happens if they're exceeded. That plan is submitted to the city, reviewed by third-party engineers, and enforced by monitoring firms who can order a work stoppage independently of the contractor. The contractor doesn't get to decide when it's too much. Someone else does.
There's a separation of powers built into the process. The people making the vibration don't get to be the people deciding if it's safe.
That's not universal globally, but in any jurisdiction with modern building codes, the US, UK, EU, Australia, Japan, it's standard practice. The monitoring firm is hired by the developer but reports to the permitting authority. Their data is live, their thresholds are preset, and their authority to stop work is real. I've read incident reports where a geophone reading spiked at 3 in the morning and work stopped within minutes.
3 in the morning. Some engineer's phone buzzes with a number and they kill a multi-million-dollar operation based on millimeters per second.
That's the system working as designed. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's start with the physics, because understanding what's actually traveling through the ground when Daniel feels that car parks shake is the key to understanding why the limits are set where they are and why the monitoring works the way it does.
All right, walk me through it. What am I feeling when the ground rumbles?
When Daniel felt that car park shake, what he was actually feeling was energy traveling through the ground as waves. Not one wave, but several types moving simultaneously. The impact from a hydraulic hammer or a blast creates what geotechnical engineers call body waves and surface waves. Body waves move through the interior of the soil and rock. Compression waves, the P waves, which push and pull the ground in the direction they're traveling, and shear waves, the S waves, which shake it perpendicular. Surface waves, primarily Rayleigh waves, roll along the top of the ground like ocean swells, and those are the ones that cause most of the structural vibration we feel.
It's less like a single punch and more like a wave tank where you've thrown a rock in. Ripples going every which way, some through the middle, some across the top.
Here's where it gets interesting for buildings. Different wave frequencies affect structures differently. Low frequency waves, under 10 Hz, tend to resonate with tall buildings because tall buildings have low natural frequencies themselves. High frequency waves, above 30 Hz, affect smaller components, window panes, plaster, brick facades. So engineers aren't just worried about too much vibration in the abstract. They're worried about which frequencies are hitting which buildings, because a level that's completely safe for a steel frame high-rise could crack the plaster in a 19th century masonry building next door.
The seam excavation could be harmless to one structure and a problem for another, purely based on how each building likes to wobble.
And that's why the pre-construction modeling phase is so critical. Before anyone fires up a hammer, geotechnical engineers drill boreholes across the site and sometimes run seismic refraction tomography, basically a small-scale seismic survey, to map exactly what's underground. They need to know soil types, layer depths, bedrock hardness, water table location. All of that feeds into finite element analysis software, PLAXIS, FLAXIS, FLAC3D, programs like that, which builds a three-dimensional model of the site and simulates how vibration will propagate from the excavation point to every adjacent structure.
They're running a simulation of the disaster before they create the possibility of one.
The simulation spits out numbers, predicted peak particle velocity at the foundation of every nearby building at multiple frequencies for each phase of the excavation. Those numbers get compared against established damage thresholds. The U.S. Bureau of Mines standard RI 857 is the one most jurisdictions reference. 12.7 millimeters per second PPV for historic or fragile buildings, 50 millimeters per second for modern reinforced concrete. If the simulation shows you'll exceed those, you change the method before you start. Slower hammer, smaller charges, different drill pattern, or physical barriers like line drilling, but we'll get to those.
The entire operation is reverse engineered from the damage limit. You start with, what can this building tolerate? And work backward to, therefore, what can we do?
That's the whole philosophy. It's not, how fast can we dig, and let's hope nothing breaks. It's what's the most fragile thing within our vibration radius, and how do we design around it? And that radius can be surprisingly large. In soft soils, vibration from rock excavation can travel hundreds of meters before it attenuates below perceptible levels. Which is why Daniel could feel it in a car park that wasn't even on the same property.
The fact that he felt, it doesn't mean danger. It means the energy traveled further than the damage threshold did.
The damage threshold is a tight circle around the excavation. The perception threshold is a much wider one, Daniel was standing in the gap between them, feeling the energy but well outside the zone where it could actually hurt anything. And that gap exists because engineers designed it to exist. Once the model says you need to reduce vibration by, say, 40% to stay under the limit for that historic masonry building on the corner, you reach for physical mitigation techniques. These are remarkably low-tech in concept. They're basically tricks to interrupt wave propagation, but the precision required is anything but simple.
What's the simplest version of this?
You drill a perimeter of empty holes around the excavation zone, typically a few inches in diameter and spaced close together. When vibration waves hit that line of holes, the air gaps act as a barrier. The wave energy can't cross efficiently because there's no continuous medium to carry it. You get a 50 to 70% reduction in peak particle velocity on the other side.
You're building a moat, but instead of water, it's just nothing. Holes full of air.
A moat of nothing. And it works beautifully for body waves traveling through rock. For surface waves, those Rayleigh waves rolling along the top, you use actual trenches. An open trench may be a meter wide and a few meters deep, cut between the excavation and the building you're protecting. Surface waves hit that gap and reflect back. They can't jump it.
I'm guessing the trench doesn't need to be permanent. You fill it back in once the risky phase of excavation is done.
It's a temporary surgical cut. The other big technique, and the one that's probably most misunderstood, is controlled blasting with millisecond delays. People hear blasting and assume it's the most dangerous method, but in practice, a properly timed blast sequence often produces lower peak vibrations than continuous impact hammering.
Because you're spreading the energy out instead of dumping it all at once.
Instead of detonating all charges simultaneously, which stacks the wave peaks on top of each other, you fire them in sequence, milliseconds apart. The total energy released is the same, but the peak particle velocity at any given moment is much lower because the waves arrive at the building staggered, not piled up. It's the difference between one person hitting a wall with a sledgehammer and 10 people hitting it one after another. Same total force, radically different peak.
Blasting can actually be the gentler option, which is completely counterintuitive.
That's one of those things that gets lost in public perception. A continuous hydraulic hammer pounding away for hours can build up cumulative vibration exposure in a way that a few seconds of properly sequenced blasts doesn't. The Salesforce Tower excavation in San Francisco in 2017 is the perfect case study. They were digging foundations right next to BART tunnels, the Bay Area Rapid Transit tubes running directly adjacent to the site. BART imposed a vibration limit of 2.5 millimeters per second. That's absurdly low. For context, that's barely above what you'd feel walking across a wooden floor.
2.5. That's a fifth of the standard limit for historic buildings.
It meant they couldn't use impact hammers at all. The modeling showed even the smallest hammer would exceed that threshold through the soil between the foundation and the tunnel walls. So they switched to hydraulic splitters, devices that expand inside pre-drilled holes, and crack the rock apart through static pressure. No impact, no vibration, just silent, slow fracture. It added weeks to the schedule and millions to the cost, but it kept the tunnels safe and the trains running.
The trade-off isn't just speed versus safety in the abstract. It's speed versus safety versus method cost versus what's adjacent. And the most fragile neighbor sets the rules for everyone.
That's the principle, and it scales up to some of the biggest projects in the world. Take Crossrail in London, tunneling directly under the Palace of Westminster. They placed geophones every 10 meters along the route above the tunnel alignment. Those sensors were measuring vibration in three axes simultaneously and feeding data back to a control room where engineers could see real-time PPV at every monitoring point. If any single geophone approached the threshold for the centuries-old masonry above, the tunnel boring machine parameters changed immediately.
Every 10 meters under Parliament. That's not a monitoring plan. That's a nervous system.
That's the right way to think about it. The pre-construction modeling is the brain. It predicts what should happen. The geophones and accelerometers are the nerve endings. They report what is happening. And the vibration control plan is the reflex arc. It says what to do when the numbers climb. That's where we're heading next. The geophones go in, the accelerometers get mounted on building facades, and the data starts flowing. A modern urban excavation monitoring setup is basically a distributed nervous system. Triaxial sensors, measuring vibration in three axes simultaneously, feeding data over cellular networks or LoRaWAN to cloud dashboards. The Hudson Yards development in New York used over 200 sensors across its platform excavation over active rail yards. And every single one of them was streaming live PPV readings to engineers who could see, second by second, exactly what each adjacent structure was experiencing.
200 sensors over a rail yard that's still running trains while you're digging above it. That's a vibration limit of what, 5 millimeters per second?
5 millimeters per second. For context, that's less than the vibration from a bus passing on a city street. And they held it. The monitoring system was layered. Geophones on the rail infrastructure itself, accelerometers on the platform columns, tilt meters on adjacent buildings. If any single sensor approached threshold, the system triggered an alert on the contractor's dashboard and on the third-party monitoring firm's screen simultaneously. No phone call needed. The data itself was the alarm.
There's no human in the loop for the detection part. The system sees the number climbing and flags it before anyone has to notice.
That's the adaptive decision-making loop in action. When monitoring shows vibration approaching limits, say you're at 40 millimeters per second and your cap is 50, the contractor has a menu of responses documented in the vibration control plan. They can switch from an impact hammer to a hydraulic breaker, which operates at lower peak force spread over a longer contact time. They can reduce the drop height on the hammer. They can change the drill pattern. More holes, smaller charges, different spacing, to spread energy over a larger area. All of this is pre-authorized. Nobody has to convene a meeting.
The plan isn't just, here's what we'll do if everything goes right. It's, here's what we'll do at 40. Here's what we'll do at 45. Here's what we'll do at 48.
And the third-party monitoring firm is the one with the authority to say, 48 is too close. Stop work now. They're hired by the developer, but their professional obligation runs to the permitting authority and their own liability insurance. They have no incentive to let things slide. A monitoring firm that lets a threshold breach go unreported is a monitoring firm that gets sued out of existence.
Which brings us to the legal framework. Because none of this works if there's no accountability for getting it wrong.
Before any excavation starts, there's a pre-construction condition survey. And this is not a guy with a clipboard glancing at the building next door. It's high-resolution photography and video of every visible surface, every crack, every settlement line, every patch of spalling concrete, on every structure within the zone of influence. Thousands of images, geotagged and timestamped, stored as a legal baseline. If a crack appears during construction, the survey answers whether it was already there.
The building's entire cosmetic history becomes a legal document. Every pre-existing flaw is evidence that protects the contractor from false claims, and every new flaw is evidence the contractor is on the hook for.
The liability clauses in these contracts are written accordingly. If vibration monitoring shows you stayed under the threshold and damage still occurs, which can happen if the modeling missed something, like an undocumented void or a soil lens that amplified frequencies unexpectedly, the insurance framework kicks in. That's what happened in Boston in 2019, the South Station excavation. A reading of 60 millimeters per second, well above the 50 millimeter limit, triggered an immediate work stoppage. Structural engineers were on site within hours inspecting the adjacent parking garage. They found cracking in several concrete columns and spalling on two floor slabs. Total repair bill, $2
million. $2 million for 60 millimeters per second. That's about $33,000 per millimeter over the line.
That's the system working even when it fails. The monitoring caught the breach, the stoppage happened, the damage was assessed and repaired, and the contractor's insurance covered it. Could the modeling have prevented it? The post-incident analysis suggested the soil report had underestimated a layer of fractured rock that transmitted vibration more efficiently than the model assumed. But the monitoring caught what the model missed. And the legal framework ensured the cost landed on the right party.
You've got three layers of protection. The model predicts, the sensors detect, and the contracts enforce. If any one layer fails, the other two are still there.
That redundancy is the whole point. The Sydney Metro excavation in 2022 is another good example. A hydraulic hammer produced a 45 millimeter per second reading, under the 50 millimeter limit, but close enough that the monitoring firm flagged it. The contractor voluntarily stopped work for 3 weeks while engineers redesigned the drill pattern to spread energy over a larger area. 3 weeks of delay on a multi-billion-dollar project because of a reading that was technically still legal.
That's the part that surprises me. The contractor chose to eat 3 weeks of schedule rather than risk pushing closer to the line.
Because the commercial calculus flips once you're near the threshold, a 3 week delay is expensive but predictable. A structural damage claim is unpredictable. It could be $2 million, it could be 20, it could involve lawsuits that drag on for years and insurance premiums that spike for a decade. In that light, the delay is the cheap option. The monitoring system doesn't just protect buildings, it protects contractors from their own incentives to push too hard.
The whole apparatus, the modeling, the sensors, the legal framework. It's not just engineering, it's engineering plus economics plus law, all aligned to make caution the rational choice.
That alignment is what makes the system so reliable. Daniel's question was basically, how do they avoid disaster? The answer is, they make disaster more expensive than caution. They measure everything in real time, and they give the power to stop work to people whose only job is safety. It's not one thing, it's the whole stack.
All of that. The modeling, the monitoring, the legal architecture, it adds up to a system where the feeling of danger is real, but the risk is managed through layers, not hope. And I keep coming back to that number you mentioned early on. Human perception kicks in at 0.5 millimeter per second. The safe limit for modern concrete is 50. That's not a small gap. That's 2 orders of magnitude.
100-to-1 ratio between I feel alarmed and the building is actually threatened. Your nervous system is basically a smoke detector that goes off when you make toast. Useful to know something's happening. Terrible at telling you whether to evacuate.
Which means the most practical thing Daniel or anyone can take away from this is that feeling the vibration doesn't equal being in danger. The system is designed so you feel it long before anything structural is at risk.
If you want to verify that for your own building, you actually can. Vibration monitoring plans are typically part of the public record in the municipal building department. They're submitted as part of the permit package. You can request them. You can see what the limits are for your specific structure, where the sensors are placed, and who the third-party monitoring firm is.
Physically, you can look for the sensors themselves. Those small silver boxes with cables running out of them, mounted on building walls at ground level or on lower floors. If you see geophones on your building, that's not a bad sign. That's the opposite.
It means your building is instrumented. Someone is watching its vitals in real time. The absence of sensors on an adjacent building next to a major excavation, that would actually concern me more.
The presence of monitoring equipment is basically a certificate that someone's paying attention. The system's visible if you know what to look for.
The broader lesson here goes beyond excavation. This is a case study in managing uncertainty where you can't eliminate the hazard. You're breaking rock in a city. The energy has to go somewhere. But you can bound it with data and redundancy until the residual risk is statistically negligible. It's the same intellectual move that makes air travel safe or nuclear power manageable. You don't pretend the dangerous thing isn't dangerous. You measure it, model it, monitor it, and build multiple independent layers of defense.
The engineering is impressive, but the real insight is the philosophy underneath. You accept that the ground will shake, you predict exactly how much, you watch it in real time, and you give someone who isn't the contractor the power to say enough. That's not a technical trick. That's an institutional design.
Daniel felt the ground shake in that car park and nothing collapsed. Not because the forces weren't real, but because an entire system of prediction, measurement, and accountability had already ensured they'd stay inside a safe envelope. The rumble he felt was the sound of a process working exactly as designed.
Where does this go next? Cities are building deeper than ever. Basements for geothermal loops, underground data centers, transit hubs that go down 8 or 10 stories into bedrock. When you're removing millions of cubic meters of rock instead of thousands, do the current vibration standards still hold up?
That's the open question, and I'm not sure anyone has a clean answer yet. The 50 millimeter per second standard was derived from studies of surface level excavation, mostly in the 1970s and 80s. When you're excavating 100 meters down, the wave propagation gets more complex. Energy can reflect off deeper rock layers in ways the standard models weren't designed for. There's talk in the geotechnical community about needing depth-dependent thresholds, but nothing's codified yet.
We're building deeper using standards calibrated for shallower. That feels like a gap waiting to be filled.
The emerging technology that might fill it is real-time digital twins, full three-dimensional models of the excavation site that update continuously with live sensor data. Instead of reacting when a geophone hits 48 millimeters per second, the twin could predict that the next hammer strike will push it over based on the trend of the last 10 strikes and adjust the drill parameters before it happens. Proactive instead of reactive.
The model stops being a pre-construction prediction and becomes a living simulation that steers the work in real time.
That's the vision. A few projects are experimenting with it. There was a pilot on a Singapore Metro extension last year, but it's not standard practice yet. The computational load is enormous, and the sensor density required is higher than most contractors want to pay for. But as sensors get cheaper and cloud processing gets faster, I think this is where we're heading.
The next time Daniel's standing in a car park feeling the ground shake, the system might already know what that shake is going to be 5 seconds before it arrives, and have already decided it's fine.
Or already decided to switch to a different hammer. Either way, the point is the same. That rumble under your feet isn't chaos. It's a carefully calibrated transfer of energy, bounded by physics, monitored by sensors, and enforced by contracts. It feels like the world is ending, but it's actually just engineering doing what engineering does, making something dangerous routine.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, Faroese seaweed harvesters relied on flocks of northern gannets to locate the densest laminaria beds. The birds would dive at high speed into the water above the kelp forests, and the harvesters would row toward the splash patterns, effectively using the gannets as living sonar.
A seabird-guided seaweed supply chain. That's clever.
I have follow-up questions about gannet training that I'm going to save for never.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, find us at myweirdprompts.com. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.